Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals, and I hope you made it here safely. The snow is a little lighter than we expected here. If we're ready to begin, let me introduce my panel here first. I'm Justice Ann Gardner, and to my left is Dixon Holman, and to my right is Bill Meyer.
Hello.
Justice is on the court. And now we'll begin. Sorry. And I'll ask Deborah, our chief clerk, to introduce the first case.
Court now called Don Norris and Avery Air Conditioning versus Shelby Jackson. May it please the court, Mr. Eric Wood will argue for appellants, Ms. Carol Wolfram will argue for appellee.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Eric Wood. I'm here representing the appellants, Don Norris and Avery Air Conditioning, in this matter. What we have here is something that should have been a relatively simple contract dispute. The appellee, Ms. Shelby Jackson, entered into a contract with Avery Air Conditioning to install an air conditioning unit, was unhappy with the installation, not of the unit itself, but with some aspects of parts of the installation. Some things were not provided as agreed, and some things were damaged during the installation. Never has there been a company which went without an unsatisfied customer, and generally the contract between the parties governs those disputes. But here, Jackson greatly inflated what should have been a simple contract dispute into essentially a fraud or a DTPA case, pleading, and the trial court incorrectly agreed that Avery somehow committed the equivalent of fraud to justify a knowing DTPA violation. Furthermore, Jackson pled and the trial court incorrectly agreed that Don Norris intentionally committed an unconscionable act under the DTPA. It's our contention that DTPA was not meant to supplant contract law, nor was unconscionability intended to be a catch-all for all types of unsavory behavior. The trial court here awarded a recovery which was legally and factually unsupported by the evidence, and to uphold it would basically award a windfall to the plaintiff. Starting with the DTPA violation, it's our contention that the violations that were alleged as DTPA violations were nothing more than mere breaches of contract. The Supreme Court in Crawford versus Ace Signs and this court in Poteet versus Kaiser tell us that the key issue in determining whether a breach of contract gives rise to a DTPA violation is whether the harm to the plaintiff was caused by the defendant's representations outside of the agreement or failure to perform some obligation under the agreement. And if it's the latter, it cannot give rise to more than a breach of contract, which is exactly what we had here. The trial court specifically found that all of the representations made by Avery prior to the contract became a part of the agreement, and any failure by Avery to comply with those was merely a breach of contract. There was no finding by the trial court of any misrepresentation by Avery outside of the contract or any failure to provide any service outside of the contract. Everything was subsumed within the contract. In appellee's brief, Tony Gerlow Motors versus Choppa further proves this point, and it is distinguishable on several grounds. In that case, you had a defendant, car dealership, representing to the plaintiff he's going to sell her a top-of-the-line automobile for X. In fact, never intending to provide that automobile, but instead provided the plaintiff with a lesser model and then kept the difference. The Supreme Court said that the failure to deliver the car alone would be simply a breach of contract. But where the difference arose and why it gave rise to a DTPA violation was because the misrepresentation and the intent never to provide at the outset, and that was what caused damage to the plaintiff, the difference in the value, and that arose outside of the contract and therefore could give rise to a DTPA violation.
Counsel, can I ask a question?
Please? Absolutely.
I'm concerned about the demand for the last $1,000 that the defendant claimed it was owed. And isn't there some evidence that the agreement, the modified agreement, was that she would not have to pay that $1,000, and that is there some evidence that the defendant always intended to demand that, or Mr. Norris did?
I'm a little I'm not quite following your question, but I'll try to answer it as best as I can.
Well, the $1,000.
The trial court did find that there was an agreement to modify the agreement from the agreed upon $8,500 to the lesser amount of $7,500, and that the plaintiff was entitled to keep that money. And it's undisputed that she always kept that money. It was never paid. So even if that could give rise to a DTPA violation, which we don't believe it could, because it wasn't, that representation was made after the fact instead of at the time, there was still no damage suffered by the plaintiff as a result of that, because she always kept that $1,000. It was never paid to Avery. So how could any DTPA violation have led to any damage when that money was never paid? It was always in the hands of the plaintiff.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that answers your question,
but
I did the best I could. Again, it's our contention that all of the representations were subsumed within the contract, and again, as I just pointed out, any alleged damages that were suffered were only from a failure to perform some obligation under the agreement. Which leads me to my next point, which is the amount of damages. The trial court found that Avery caused Ms. Jackson to suffer.
Before you leave, there's nothing in the case that's not covered in the contract. So I'm looking at exhibits that are attached to your brief that are exhibits number, trial court exhibit 3, your exhibit C, and trial court exhibit D. Your exhibit D and your exhibit E. Where in any one of those did we talk about a $500 tax credit?
It was not included in that.
And therefore, the contention that that was a representation and a part of the discussion between your client and Ms. Jackson would be a item that was outside the contract that the trial court specifically found in the findings of fact as having been a misrepresentation.
Well, I think the trial court found that that representation regarding the tax certificate did become part of the agreement. Even though it was not specifically written in the agreement, there were other representations that weren't specifically in the written agreements that are attached as exhibits.
Well, then how come those couldn't be considered to be misrepresentations if they were not carried out?
Because they were only promises under the overall agreement. The trial court found that all of it became part of the agreement, and when you say, I'm going to provide a $500 tax certificate, and then you don't do so, you've merely breached a promise under the agreement. Whether it was an oral or a written term of the agreement, the trial court found that it all was subsumed within the same agreement, and a failure to perform some obligation under that agreement is merely a breach of contract.
As I read item number 17 in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, what the court's saying is that the employees failed to deliver the bargained for government eligibility certificate for a $500 income tax credit. Now, you read that as saying that the court's finding that it was a part of a contract?
I'm believing that the court found that all of the promises, including Avery didn't provide the tax certificate, the court stated became part of the agreement, and that would include that. That's correct.
You think it's coincidental that the $500 amount that's found as actual damages is the same $500 amount that's covered in the undelivered tax certificate?
It may be somewhat coincidental, and I'll address that point further.
All right. Thank you for answering my question, sir.
With regard to the damages, again, we don't believe that there is evidence to show that there was any actual damages above and beyond the $1,000, which I previously addressed, because that was always held in the plaintiff's hands. With regard to the $500 tax certificate, it's our contention that there was not evidence before the court that money was ever actually damages was ever actually suffered by the plaintiff, because she didn't put forth evidence that a tax certificate was required to claim a tax credit. There was no CPA or tax expert to testify that such a certificate was required, or that Jackson tried to get the credit but was refused by the IRS because she didn't have the certificate. And it's our contention that that evidence was necessary to show that she needed the certificate to claim the credit. We believe she could claim it today if she so chose. It's the plaintiff's burden to prove that but for that certificate, she would have received the benefit of $500, and there was no evidence to justify such a finding, nor was there any evidence to justify any other finding of damages of $500, because, again, the plaintiff's own testimony was that the $1,000 covered all of her damages, and the trial court so found in its rulings. The plaintiff's own testimony was that that was supposed to cover the damaged clock, her own words, the damaged door frame, the compressor, the whirly birds, the insulation that wasn't installed, the duct work. So again, in order for that judgment to stand, there would have had to have been some damages above and beyond that $1,000. And for the reasons I've stated, the tax credit, there was just no evidence to justify a finding of actual harm of $500.
Can I go back to the $1,000 for a minute? Wasn't there evidence that the defendant did not intend to let her keep that $1,000 when it made the modified agreement, that they were going to collect it later? And then, yes, I know she kept it in her hand, but didn't the defendant sue her? Or I guess it'd be cross-pit. Didn't Avery sue her for the $1,000 to try to get it back?
That was a counterclaim that was raised after the lawsuit was filed by the plaintiff. That's correct. But again, it's our contention for there to have been a finding of actual loss, that money would have had to have been turned over to the defendant. Because she always possessed it in her hand, she didn't suffer any actual pecuniary loss of that $1,000. She always held it. Regardless of whether the defendant chose to go after her for that money later on, she never paid it, and so she always kept it. Moving on to the next point, unless there are any further questions on this, I'd like to address the unconscionability of Don Norris's actions, which, as the court knows well, the definition of unconscionability is taking advantage of the plaintiff to a grossly unfair degree. And quite simply, it's our belief that Don Norris's action of calling the plaintiff 3 months after this transaction was completed in an effort to collect a debt which he thought was owed can't constitute an unconscionable act as a matter of law. And never has there been a case in this state, nor has Jackson pointed to one, in which the court has found such behavior to constitute an unconscionable act. And doing so here, its our contention would grossly inflate the legislature's intent under the DTPA, which is intended to protect consumers from misrepresentations made at the outset of contracts for goods and services. Here we have someone calling the plaintiff 3 months after the fact, making threatening comments, had nothing to do with the original fairness of the sale of the air conditioning unit or the installation of the unit. And there's never been a case where such can be considered unconscionable behavior. The Chastain case, which is cited repeatedly in our brief, is instructive here, where you have a similar situation, a defendant calling a plaintiff well after the fact, making threats, which were even worse than Don Norris's threats, saying the defendant telling the plaintiff he's going to knock his head off and his teeth out. Court found that had nothing to do with the original fairness of the transaction. It was made much later after the fact and couldn't constitute an unconscionable act as a matter of law. We believe that case is clearly instructive here. With regard to the damages suffered from Don Norris's action, the trial court didn't find any actual economic damages from Don Norris's actions, only mental anguish damages in the amount of $2,500. And it's our contention, again, that there's no evidence or insufficient evidence to justify that finding for a number of reasons. The plaintiff admits in her own brief that she must put forward direct evidence of the nature, duration, and severity of her mental anguish, establishing a substantial disruption in her daily routine. The testimony that the plaintiff provided stated that her blood pressure rose after this phone call. She worries more, doesn't sleep as well, is not as energetic, and is tired from stress, and was really upset. These conclusory statements don't show more than mere worry, anxiety, embarrassment, or anger under the case law, particularly the cases decided by this court, which are cited in my brief. Anderson versus Long and Ramsey versus Spray decided just 2 months ago, you had a plaintiff putting forth equal to or worse evidence of mental anguish, it's our contention, then that was what was put forth here. And in both cases, this court found as a matter of law, it couldn't constitute proper recoverable mental anguish damages. In conclusion, it's our contention, and this isn't even really disputed, that if there is no finding of actual damages, then there can be no finding of treble damages or attorney's fees. And if there is a finding of attorney's fees, it's our contention that the amount awarded by the trial court was unsupported by the evidence, and that if there is a finding, that should be remanded to the trial court for a reasonableness determination. Again, I see I have about a minute left. I'll answer any other questions. If not, if there aren't any, I'll save any argument for rebuttal.
Mr. Wood, look at your Exhibit D, please. It's attached to your brief. Why is the word right at the bottom of the first paragraph where it says replace, it looks like some duck runs and it's marked through and something's written under it, all, and it looks like an initial? So on the day of March the 30th of 07, was this document modified to include that replacing all the ductwork is necessary is what was going to be the job, the representation of what would be done?
That's correct. The agreement was that all of the ductwork would be provided, or replaced, excuse me.
And then what happened is on this charge slip, that's the write-up of the $7,500, that also appears, I can't tell by looking at the exhibit, if that was on 3/30/07 also, whenever Shelley Jackson signed that.
That appears to be correct.
All right, thank you. All that happened the same day.
Although, excuse me, I do want to clarify. I believe that the, my time is up, man.
That's okay.
Answer your question.
Answer.
Okay, I believe that the agreement to provide the ductwork was actually signed the day before. The charge slip was signed the day after. I believe that is what the evidence shows.
So it's a 24-hour difference, at least, in terms of what you said.
Correct. We're talking about a two-day period total from the time that the installation was started and it was completed, and that would have been during the second day that this agreement, and then the charge slip would have been on the first day, the second day.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Wilford?
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. I represent Ms. Shelby Jackson, who is the appellee in this case, and I believe it would be instructive to consider what it is with respect to this appeal that the appellants have conceded with respect to not what they contested at trial, but what they have conceded for purposes of this appeal. They have conceded that they made all the misrepresentations that were complained of, because their arguments have been restricted to it's a mere breach of contract and there are no damages. So they have essentially conceded that they made all the misrepresentations complained of. They have conceded that all of the misrepresentations were binding on Avery, which was a finding of fact they have not contested. They have conceded that Avery failed to disclose information concerning goods or services, which was known at the time of the transaction, if such failure to disclose was intended to induce appellee into a transaction she would not otherwise have entered into. They have not even briefed that finding of the court upon which judgment is based. Their argument today in their briefing before this court has been limited to affirmative misrepresentations and not a failure to disclose. But the court also based her judgment on a failure to disclose information, which is a separate item which would uphold the judgment. And our contention would be that argument with respect to anything of that nature is now waived for failure to brief and argue. Appellants have conceded that Avery's actions were committed knowingly. That has not been challenged. They have conceded that Norris's actions were committed intentionally and with intent to coerce, harm, and harass Mrs. Jackson. Those are all findings in the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law, none of which have been challenged by appellants. They have conceded that Mr. Norris's actions are completely attributable to Avery, which is the basis for the amended final judgment, in which Avery was then found jointly and severally liable for the actions of Mr. Norris. That has not been complained of before this court. They have conceded that Mrs. Jackson's reliance was reasonable. They have not challenged that. The court made a specific finding, and they have not challenged that. All of their briefing goes to verbal misrepresentations. And under the Texas Supreme Court holding of Formosa Plastics, it has long been the law in the state of Texas that there is a duty on parties to refrain from inducing a person into a contract by fraudulent misrepresentations or a failure to disclose. That is not a mere breach of contract. The court has found, the trial court found that there was a failure to disclose, so that we're already looking at more than a mere breach of contract. Avery basically has conceded that it breached that duty by not arguing that that was error on the part of the court to so find. The trial court found that Avery misrepresented rights, duties, and obligations under the contract. That is more than a mere breach of contract. That is in addition to the existence of a contract. That is in addition to misrepresenting rights, duties, and obligations is a different animal than simply breaching a contract. And with respect to the Supreme Court decision of Tony Gullo, I don't know if I'm saying that right, Gullo, where they upheld a DTPA violation for failure to provide the right model. It is our contention that that is exactly what has happened in this particular case. Avery represented that it would provide a model of a certain type of heating and air conditioning unit, whereby Avery would provide, not just the government, they represented both that the government would provide it, but they also represented, and the record supports, that Avery made the representation that Avery itself would provide the $500 tax certificate. That's not the model they provided. They said that comes with it. That was a material part of what they said would be included. That's nowhere in the contract. That is an outside representation. Avery represented that it would provide a model of a heating and air conditioning unit that would recoup the cost of the unit in 3 to 4 years. The evidence clearly shows and is uncontroverted that the initial cost of the unit was $8,500, and that was later reduced to $7,500. The evidence also shows that that didn't happen. Avery made representations that they were selling her a model that came with certain services, which they did not provide. A lifetime warranty. There was testimony that there was a plus or minus 2-degree range between rooms of the airflow and the temperature. Mr. Clark testified that that would have been provided. Mr. Norris said, nope, we didn't give that to her. But that was part of the representation made to her at the initiation of the transaction that's not in the documentation, but and which was not provided, and which the trial court found was a basis of reasonable reliance by Mrs. Jackson and also was a misrepresentation under the agreement. And I would just also like to point out a disagreement with respect to what the court's findings of fact are. There has been a strenuous argument made by appellants that all of the representations made at the initiation of the contract then became a part of the agreement. I do not believe, based on the court's finding of fact, that that argument holds water. And I would refer the court, this is Exhibit A, to the appellant's initial brief, which are the findings of fact. I would refer the court to finding of fact number 7, in which the court found that Mr. Settles, who was the original salesperson, made specific oral and written warranties to Jackson, which became a part of the agreement and the consumer transaction. Paragraph 8 is a separate paragraph, says Settles made representations to Jackson and then goes on to list different representations, including that she would recoup the cost of the unit in 3 to 4 years, that she would be provided a tax credit of $500, that she would be provided 12 inches of insulation, and that Avery had honesty above reproach. The court nowhere in the findings says that these representations are a part of the agreement. And so I think that there that appellant's argument is too much of a stretch to say that all of these things became a matter of the contract. Also, with respect to misrepresentations concerning the rights, duties, and obligations under the contract, when Mr. Norris got involved and began to threaten Mrs. Jackson, he represented to her basically that he had the right under the contract to continue to collect the $1,000, and in fact, Avery went ahead and sued on it. The court found that the modification of the contract was, which ipso facto would be an ongoing transaction because there was a modification of this contract, that that was effective, that the $8,500 was in fact reduced to $7,500, and that that modification was binding on Avery. Mr. Norris represented to Mrs. Jackson that that was not so. Mr. Norris represented to Mrs. Jackson that she had an ongoing duty to pay that $1,000. The court found, and the appellants do not challenge, that his conduct was intentional, that it was intended to coerce, harass, and harm her, and that he knew better than to claim that the contract gave him those rights. He basically claimed he had a right to put a lien on her home. We're talking about a 70-year-old retired grandmother who grew up in the Appalachian Mountains and went to boarding school and did not even grow up living in her own home. She was a grandma off on her own with no other source of support other than herself, and this is all substantiated in the record. Mr. Norris was the manager of an established company, and he's taking advantage of her. He is basically saying, I have the right to take your home.
Ms. Wolfram, how do you address the contention on the part of the appellant that the activities Mr. Norris was undertaking were well past the time in which there was an exchange of representations and warranties discussion had between the consumer, your client, and the provider of the good or service, and therefore the subsequent conduct could not have been the producing cause of the problems with the deceptive activities before the transaction was actually entered into?
Your Honor, here's the way I would respond to that. A couple of different ways. One is in the Supreme Court case of Flinnigan, which was obviously decided before the Coons case and the Woodruff case, said that it doesn't have to be at the inception of the transaction. Neither Coons or Woodruff overruled Flinnigan, but what was different about the facts of those cases is that it was clear in both Coons and Woodruff that the transaction had been completely concluded. In fact, in the Parkway against Woodruff case, the plaintiff in that case tried to argue that there was an ongoing violation and that there was an ongoing transaction. The court came in and specifically said, no, that's not the case. And they addressed that issue before they got to the issue of the unconscionability. And I think that that is a material distinction that was a part of the basis of the holding in the Woodruff case. In our case would be very similar to the Hamrick case, which was the Houston livestock case. That's not a Texas Supreme Court case, but I think it's very instructive. And what was being discussed there, and there are other cases that we cited in our brief as well, where if you have an ongoing transaction and your transaction is not complete, there are either additional services or payments or some sort of conduct on behalf of the parties that is still owed, then you have an ongoing transaction. I think that's what we have here. Even conceded in the, I believe it's in the reply brief by the appellants, they concede that there was an ongoing warranty. So there were additional services. Also, the trial testimony showed that they had not delivered the tax certificate. They, in fact, never delivered the tax certificate. There was evidence that Mrs. Jackson continued to call Avery and request the tax certificate. There were ongoing representations to her that it was imminently on its way to her. And so that part of the transaction was still ongoing. The court specifically found that those representations made by Avery's staff were binding on Avery. And so you have an ongoing transaction. There were additional service calls under the agreement that they were owed, the plus or minus 2% guarantee. So I think that there is a material distinction there.
Thank you, counsel.
Pardon?
Your time. Oh, I'm sorry.
Is my time up?
Not quite.
Okay. Your Honor, just briefly, a couple of sentences with respect to the mental anguish. There's a Texas Supreme Court case called Bentley against Button, and that court found the Supreme Court in that case disagreed with the amount of damages of mental anguish. But importantly, it found that it was undeniable that mental anguish had occurred. And the facts of that case were actually less than the facts of this case. And so I'd argue that, yes, there is Supreme Court precedence to uphold the mental anguish award. And then with respect to the attorney fee award, I would just say that the Texas Supreme Court has set out a number of different factors which go into a proper award of a reasonable attorney's fees, only one of which is the results obtained. I wish the results had been higher for my client than they were, but we were a prevailing party in the lawsuit, and there was testimony that specifically that all of the 1.04 factors were complied with for setting up the attorney's fees and that they were reasonably awarded. Thank you for your time.
May it please the court. I'll try to be brief in my reply and not be redundant. One item that was pointed out by opposing counsel was that appellants conceded that they made misrepresentations, and I want to make clarification there. Avery and Don Norris never conceded they made any misrepresentations. What they have done with their brief is stated that any failures to comply with any allegations merely were breaches of a contract. They were not conceding that there were any misrepresentations made. It's our contention that Ms. Jackson got exactly what she contracted for, an air conditioning unit of a certain size and material, and that the system is working in the house today. The damages aren't with regard to the actual system itself. Again, it was with regard to certain items that were not provided or certain items that were damaged during the construction of the or installation of the unit. But again, it's our contention that none of the damages or none of the evidence put on at trial totaled over the $1,000, which was the contract modification and always remained in possession of the plaintiff. With regard to the $500, again, it's curious as to where the trial court came up with that number, but the only number that's close to that was the tax certificate, and as I've already addressed, there was no evidence that $500 in damages was actually suffered by the plaintiff. She could claim that tax credit today. With regard to failing to provide a system that didn't pay for itself in 3 to 4 years, the trial court made no such finding that caused the plaintiff any particular amount of damages, certainly not $500 worth. With regard to the warranty being canceled, the trial court made no such finding that the warranty was ever canceled. In fact, the warranty is in place today. The trial court, or the testimony of Don Norris, which was unrebutted, stated that the warranty is still there today. Same with the airflow, which was allegedly improper. There was no finding by the trial court that caused the plaintiff to suffer $500 in damages. Moving on to Don Norris again. Don Norris wasn't trying to take advantage of anyone. He was trying to collect money which he believed was owed under a contract. And again, it had nothing to do with the original fairness of the transaction for the sale and installation of an air conditioning unit. His comments may have been rude. His comments may have been threatening, but they were made well after the fact, and they had nothing to do with the original fairness of the transaction. And under Chastain, that can't constitute unconscionability as a matter of law. There is a statute to protect plaintiffs from this type of behavior, and it's the Texas Debt Collection Act. But that statute was not before the court because the plaintiff waited until the last minute to plead it, and it was stricken. So they're basically trying to use unconscionability as an umbrella for all kinds of unsavory behavior, such as rude comments and threats made by Don Norris after the fact. And never in this state has there ever been a case which has expanded the definition of unconscionability so far.
Counsel, can you address the failures to disclose that she mentioned? That the failure to disclose information that was mentioned by Ms. Wolfram.
With regard to Don Norris?
Oh, either defendant.
Well,
as a theory under the DTPA.
I don't know that there was a failure to disclose any particular item. The trial court's finding is a little bit curious as to what she was talking about in that judgment, because there was no specific list of what item was supposed to have been disclosed by Avery, but that wasn't disclosed in an effort to induce her into the contract. So I don't know that there was any failure to disclose any particular item, and there certainly wasn't any intent at the outset by Avery when the contract was entered into. With regard to Don Norris, he never even spoke to the plaintiff until June 27th, but one time. And his conversation on March 30th was, we'll provide the ductwork. And again, it's our contention that if the ductwork wasn't provided, which is what the trial court found, that's merely a breach of the contract. It's merely a breach of some obligation that they contracted to provide and collected money for. So again, neither of those can constitute a DTPA violation.
What was the testimony at trial as to how Mr. Norris failed to see this charge slip, or how did he explain it away?
How did he
explain it away? It says it's $7,500 what's owed, and if he thought he still owed $8,500, he must have not seen or else had some other interpretation of this charge slip.
Well, his testimony at trial was that it was his belief and the other employees of Avery's belief that the charge slip was for only $7,500, but that's not a completion slip. That's just a charge slip for what's owed as of that day. And it was their testimony that they believed the agreement with Ms. Jackson was that she was going to be able to keep the $1,000 until Avery returned to correct the deficiencies, any problems that she had.
Did Avery return and correct the deficiencies?
It tried to do so, but never. The deficiencies were never corrected.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. We appreciate your arguments, and thank you for making the trip up here, down here, and your case is submitted. You'll be hearing from us shortly.
Thank you for your time, Your Honor.